unprepared and in parts disjointed. It was delivered in a hushed, sometimes inaudible voice, but it was the most convincing piece of human truth I have ever heard on the subject. In his response, Dr. Bierski raised the trial to a new moral height. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 216, Gideon Hausner's Justice in Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Let us begin by citing again the opening statement of Israel's Attorney General Gideon Hausner at the trial of Adolf Eichmann. Hausner said, "As I stand before you, Shoftei Yisrael, judges of Israel, to lead the prosecution of Adolf Eichmann, I do not stand alone. With me in this place and at this hour stand 6 million accusers, but they cannot rise to their feet and point an accusing finger towards the man who sits in the glass dock and cry, 'J'accuse,' for their ashes were piled up in the hills of Auschwitz and in the fields of Treblinka, or washed away by the rivers of Poland. Their graves are scattered over the length and breadth of Europe. Their blood cries out, but their voices are not heard. Therefore, it falls to me to be their spokesman and to unfold in their name the awesome indictment." End quote. In this opening statement, Hauser makes two allusions to two texts, one ancient, one modern. The first, as I mentioned in the previous episode, is to the biblical story of Cain and Abel, and to the Almighty statement, to Cain, "Kol d'mei achicha, the blood of your brother cries out to me from the ground." The second reference, made when Hausner said "J'accuse," is to the famous Emile Zola statement regarding the Dreyfus Affair, one of the many examples of the festering anti-Semitism in Europe. A festering anti-Semitism that led Zionists to conclude that Jews had no future in the continent. By his opening statement, Hausner made clear that his goal was, as it were, to make heard the voices of those murdered in the Holocaust, voices that would speak through those of the survivors, so that the court and the audience and Israel and the world would hear not only about the evil efficiency with which Eichmann effectuated the bringing of so many Jews to the camps, but also about the larger evil worldview that Eichmann himself so single-mindedly sought to advance. There is, we must add, another goal that Hausner had. Hausner sought to ensure that those that had grown up in the Holy Land, Sabras, cultivate a greater sense of empathy for those who went through the Holocaust. And as one of Israel's most famous poets would later reflect, it was this goal of Hausner that would become one of the many important legacies of the trial. Gideon Hausner described all his efforts at the trial in his own memoir, Justice in Jerusalem. And as he made clear in his own reflections and as can be seen from the trial, Hausner wished to ensure that this would be no ordinary criminal case, and it would not even be like Nuremberg. As the documentary The Trial of Adolf Eichmann notes, at Nuremberg, the survivors had not testified. Their voices were not heard, but here they would be heard. The historian Deborah Lipstadt put the difference as follows, quote, "At Nuremberg, the perpetrators and their documents had been at the center. The victims had barely been a sidebar. Hausner's determination that this trial would be founded on the human story of the Jewish victims' suffering stands from a perspective of 5 decades as the trial's most significant legacy." And Lipstadt adds, "The survivors' presence in the witness box moved their intensely personal stories from the private to the public realm. Many survivors had, of course, told their stories before, but never had such a steady stream of them appeared on an internationally illuminated stage. Through their testimony, what happened to European Jewry was transformed in the public's consciousness. The trial and the debate that followed inaugurated a slow process whereby the topic of the Holocaust became a matter of concern, not only to the Jewish community, but to a larger and broader realm of people. However, before it could become something that transcended the parameters of the Jewish community, both the event and the people whose lives it had devastated had to be embraced in a far more personal, vivid, and intimate way by other Jews. That process was generated by the trial." End quote. We will describe in a later episode the criticisms leveled by the presiding judge against Hausner and why Hausner was ultimately proven correct in his approach. For now, let us discuss how Hausner effectuated his trying of the case. He not only documented the many horrific crimes of Eichmann, he also brought forward diverse survivors of the Holocaust to describe their experiences. Lipstadt describes the testimony of Ada Lichtman. Quote, "Speaking in Yiddish, the language that evoked the voices of so many victims, she described how the Germans conducted a mass shooting, killing adults and children. I saw everything. An equally harrowing scene was described by Rivka Yosaluska. She told the court how a German shooter debated whom to shoot first, her or the child she was holding. After the child was shot, she fell into the pit that already held the bodies of most of her family. Miraculously, she was later able to crawl out. When she did, she saw a fountain of blood spurting from the ground. End quote. As Lipstadt and other historians describe, perhaps one of the most famous moments in the trial came during the testimony of another survivor, Moshe Bieski, who is at that point a magistrate in Israel, describing the horrific hanging of a young boy watched by many others in the camp. Hausner put forward a question that no one expected him to put forward. Hausner said to Bieski, quote, "Why didn't you revolt?" End quote. We must understand, ladies and gentlemen, that Hausner did not ask this question, God forbid, in order to criticize Bieski. Rather, Hausner knew that there were some Sabras, some natural-born Israelis, that had trouble identifying with those that had gone through the Holocaust, and he wanted Bieski to speak for the survivors. Bieski gave a very halting reply, and I quoted as cited by Lipstadt with a few bracketed interpolated words in order to help the coherence. Bieski said, "I cannot describe this terror-inspiring fear. Nearby us, there was a Polish camp. There were 1,000 Poles. 100 meters beyond the camp, they had a place to go to, their homes. I don't recall one instance of escape on the part of the Poles. But where could any of the Jews go? We were wearing clothes which were dyed yellow with yellow stripes. In the hair at the center of our head, they made a kind of swath in a stripe 4 centimeters in width. And at that moment, let us suppose that the 15,000 people within the camp even succeeded without armed strength to go beyond the boundaries of the camp. Where would they go? What could they do?" End quote. This was not a question that Bieski had expected to be asked, and his answer in the end was incredibly powerful. As Lipstadt points out, Gideon Hausner asked Moshe Bieski this question, not because Hausner believed it was a just question, but on the contrary, Hausner asked it in front of the audience because Hausner wanted to show the audience how utterly unfair such a question was. Lipstadt reflected on the importance of Bieski's testimony in her own college teaching about the Holocaust. She writes, quote, "After reading Bieski's unrehearsed answer, I photocopied it and slipped the page into the file folder I use for my weekly lectures in my Holocaust history course. Someday, probably long before this manuscript appears as a book, a student will ask, 'Why didn't they fight back?' and I will give her the spontaneous testimony Gideon Hausner elicited from a very brave, but at that moment, rebroken man." End quote. Hausner himself, as cited by the historian Yechiam Weitz, describes the pain that Bieski felt in the moment, and Hausner reflected on the importance, in his view, of that moment at the trial. Hausner wrote, quote, "My question struck him like a blow between the eyes. A grimace of pain distorted his intelligent features. The strong, sturdy man who an hour before had declined the court's offer to allow him to sit while testifying, and had almost dispassionately unfolded hair-raising scenes of horror, now asked for permission to be seated. I was sorry to have to do this to him. 'Why did you not at least warn me beforehand?' he later reproached me." And Hausner further added, "My justification was the reply he gave to my question. Unprepared and in parts disjointed, it was delivered in a hushed, sometimes inaudible voice, but it was the most convincing piece of human truth I have ever heard on the subject." In his response, Dr. Bieski raised the trial to a new moral height. End quote. Yechiam Weitz, in his own scholarly appreciation of Hausner, from which we shall quote more tomorrow, noted that Hausner correctly saw this trial as, quote, "a unique historic legal case whose contribution was a turning point in Jewish history and fundamental to Holocaust remembrance in Israel," end quote. And perhaps the most eloquent appreciation of what occurred in this trial came from the Israeli poet Chaim Guri, cited by Lipstadt. Guri had served as a correspondent during the trial, and he reflected on how some Israelis had previously seen the survivors. He wrote, quote, "We must ask the forgiveness of the multitudes whom we have judged in our hearts, we who are outside that circle, and we often judge them without asking ourselves what right we had to do so," end quote. What was forged, in other words, ladies and gentlemen, at this trial was a greater sense of unity among the Jews of Israel and an understanding by these Israelis of what it meant for their brethren to rebuild their lives after experiencing such horror. Through this trial, many in Israel achieved a greater empathy with their brethren, as well as an appreciation of their courage that they showed in building their lives anew in Israel, a courage that deserves to be remembered till this day. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.